Session number 16075, Reel 4.
Crew Captain Goodman, Reel 4.
Perhaps the Dutch took the tags. It's difficult to imagine that this was so, because no rank was ever given. It was just your initials and surname, and whether you were a Roman Catholic or Church of England or whatever. So perhaps he wasn't wearing them. It really doesn't matter anyway. But later on, of course, it was revealed that the unknown airman was in fact Wing Commander Gibson VC, leader of the raid on the dams. So Gibson had gone, and that, of course, caused, I think, quite a loss of morale around the stations in Five Group. You get used to these big personalities being around. And although Gibson was a bit of a brash individual, of course, his squadron would follow him anywhere. The same was true of Cheshire, Leonard Cheshire, whom I got to know quite well. But the difference between the two, really, they both got the VC, of course, both got the Victoria Cross, both led the Dambusters, but they were completely different. Cheshire was a very calm man. He never raised his voice. He would ask people to do things, and they just did them. And although people would follow Gibson everywhere, they would also follow Cheshire anywhere. So they were great men in completely different ways. And Cochrane, the AOC of the group, Air Vice Marshal Cochrane, had been a flight commander under Sir Arthur Harris years and years before the war. And Donald Bennett, the AOC of the Pathfinders, had been a flight commander under him too. So it was natural that when the war came, when he trusted people like them, they should become his air officers commanding. And again, Cochrane and Bennett were completely different. Bennett was an airman extraordinary. He was a great one for showing people how to do things. And it didn't matter what you thought you could do, he could do it better in the air. And he was everlastingly demonstrating this to people. If you thought you could get a target error of, shall we say, 100 yards, Bennett could demonstrate that he could do it and get an error of 50 yards. Cochrane was quite different. He was much more the staff officer and leader, but nevertheless, he was a great leader of men too. He wasn't a great aviator, but he did go. He certainly did one operational sortie that I remember. He went with the Sasso of the group, and he went as navigator in a Mosquito to a target in France. So you've got to take your hat off to people who will do that kind of thing, because had he been shot down and made a prisoner, he would no doubt have been a highly prized prisoner of the Germans. There's no doubt about that. So there they were, these men, and we looked up to them, we really did, and we looked up to Butch Harris too. Not that we ever saw him on the stations. He used to come to stations sometimes, but not very often. But he was there, and everybody knew he was there, and everybody knew what he had to do on the stations. And if he had come to the station, he would have had very little to say except, Berlin is that-a-way, 450 miles up the road, get going. And that's what you did.
Are there any specific occasions when you met these three, Cheshire, Bennett and Cochrane, which stick out in your mind, occasions when you met them in the war?
Mm. Certainly Bennett. When I was at Oakington in 8 Group, we did a Pathfinder attack on, I can't remember the name of it now, Hanover. Yes, I'm sure it was Hanover. And it was an all-Mosquito attack. And the idea was that we were to broadcast as much as possible, because the Mosquitoes weren't easily intercepted by the German night fighters. You tended to be in and out before they knew you were there. They got to really get their skates on to catch you. And this attack was to be launched specially for the BBC to record. And Stuart McPherson, who was one of the ace recorders of the time and commentators, came up to Oakington with his team. And the idea was that they would record the briefing, they would record mosquitoes taking off, they would record chit-chat in the air, they would record them on the circuit coming back, and the landing, and then the debriefing, and this is the way it went. And for the only time in my life, I was on the air, on the BBC, flying downwind at Oakington, calling Penrib 37 downwind, and the tower answered, Penrib 37 clear to final. And then as I got to the final turn in to the approach, Penrib 37 final, and the tower said, Penrib 37 clear to land, and I landed. And afterwards the debriefing. And when it was all over, it was played back by Stuart McPherson, and it was very successful. It was clear that the whole thing was great, and Bennett was there, and he was highly delighted. He was a very frosty individual, and you could never tell whether he was really pleased or not, but he got his wintry smile on. And one of our chaps was very foolish. He squared up to Bennett and said, well, sir, that was jolly good, wasn't it? And Bennett said, yes, what did you think of it? And he said, oh, I thought it was jolly good, sir. And don't you think that we deserve a stand down after this? And Bennett turned on him and said, I'll decide when you get a stand down. And for the next 7 nights, our squadron was on the battle order. Normally we would have been a night on and a night off. So that punished us for having the temerity to square up to Pathfinder Bennett.
Have you got an occasion that you can recollect for Ralph Cochran and Cheshire during the war?
Not Cochran, not really, no. He didn't come down to see us much. Oh, well, we used to have what were called wash-ups. After a raid, if anything had gone wrong, we would have a debriefing in the station cinema at Coningsby. And all the crews had to be there. That's the Lancaster Pathfinder crews, 617 and 627, while the great ones went into what had gone wrong. And I well remember that one night, my good friend Flying Officer George Platts of 627 Squadron got in under the carpet of flares. We were going after a particular marshalling yard, and there was another one nearby, and he went and laid markers on that one. Which was quite wrong. Of course, it was heresy. You mustn't do a thing like that. And it was before we had developed a technique that if a marker was in the wrong place, another mosquito was detailed to go in and drop a yellow alongside it. And the rule in Bomber Command was if you see a red marker on the ground with a yellow alongside it, you do not bomb. But if you see markers with greens alongside them, you do bomb. But at the beginning when we were doing this, we only had reds anyway. So George Platts had got this marker down in the wrong yard, and the other mosquitoes got them down in the right yard. And so, of course, the master bomber was trying to explain to the crews coming along behind that they were to bomb between the two markers that they could see in one yard. But unfortunately, of course, some of them decided that the two markers were George Platz's markers and the nearer marker in the main yard, so bombs were dropped between those two. So to some extent the raid went adrift, and there was one heck of a row in the station cinema, and Cochrane did not like it at all. And Air Commodore Sharp, who was the base commander, that's to say he was the Air Commodore in charge of Coningsby and Woodhall Spa, eventually summed it up by saying, Flying Officer Platz is only too willing to admit he boobed. He dropped the markers on the right place in the wrong yard. And that, of course, brought the house down. And even Cochrane permitted himself one of his wintry smiles.
I think there was actually a case which you didn't see yourself, but of a pilot who was shot down by a V1.
Yes, that's true. It was Flying Officer George Platz, the man who put down the markers on the right aiming point in the wrong marshalling yard. He, later on, this was in the middle of June 44, was detailed to be one of 4 markers who were to mark in daylight. Before D-Day, we didn't ever mark in daylight, but after that, it became much easier to roam all over Europe without being intercepted. So there was a target behind the Pas-de-Calais at a place, if I remember rightly, it was called Saint-Leu-d'Esseron. I wouldn't be quite sure of this, But anyway, it was a huge cliff at the bottom of which the Germans had built subterranean tunnels, and they were storing their V1s and some V2s in there. So obviously this was a target that had got to be knocked out if possible. An attempt was made to drop bombs at the bottom of the cliff to try and collapse it, but this didn't work. So it was decided that 617 Squadron would drop tall boy bombs. They were 12,000 pounders, armour-piercing bombs, which had vanes on them, which made them spin, so that the bomb, when it entered the ground, was rather like a Black and Decker drill, and it went straight on down through the chalk or concrete or whatever it might be. And they were to drop these on this cliff. But 627 was to do the marking. And this is something that isn't generally realised, that there were occasions on which 627 would mark for the mighty 617. And it's a point that I really feel I would like to make at this stage. Anyway, four of our markers were detailed, including my good friend Flying Officer George Platts and another one named Saint Smith, who was an Australian who had become one of our leading markers by then. So away they all went with 12 Lancasters of 617 as well, and they made this great blob of red on top of the cliff, and in came 617 Lancasters, one after the other, very carefully dropping their tall boys. And one bomb hit the top of the cliff and went in and exploded, but it didn't collapse the cliff. And then a quite incredible thing happened. A following Lancaster dropped a tall boy into the crater made by the first one. Whether this sort of thing was ever done again, I don't know, but it was on this occasion. And it exploded, and the whole cliff collapsed like a house of cards on the V1s and V2s, and also a lot of Germans that were down there. So that was a very successful trip. The markers turned for home, and of course it wasn't far to the coast, but they got to go across the Pas-de-Calais, which was festooned with these doodlebug launching sites. And they were unfortunate in that they flew over the top of one launching site just as a doodlebug was launched. And it got airborne, and as so often happened with these things, they would sometimes get airborne, and the engine would cut, and then the thing would dive to earth and explode. So the Germans, some Germans, were quite likely to be killed by their own doodlebug, you see, which was good. Anyway, the mosquitoes came across, and they were stepped down in line astern. That's to say that marker leader was at the top of the stack at about 1,000 feet, and then a couple of hundred feet below him was number two, then number three, then number four. And number four was fairly close to the deck, and he was Flying Officer Saint Smith. The doodlebug was launched. It stalled, crashed, exploded under Saint Smith's mosquito, which turned over on its back and dived into the ground, and Saint Smith and his navigator, Gale, both Australians, were killed. Above him, a couple of hundred feet up, was Flying Officer George Platts, with whom I had flown Wellingtons at Harwell years before, and both of his engines were stopped by the blast of this doodlebug, and although he pumped the throttles, they didn't pick up, and so he had to make a crash landing among all these doodlebug sites as best he could. And the mosquito hit the deck at quite a high speed and careered through a couple of fields and stopped. And George Platts broke a leg in the crash. His navigator Griffiths was hanging on like grim death, but he was all right. He was just shaken up. And Platts said, "Look, I've got a broken leg, Griff. For goodness sake, open up the lid and get out and run for it." So Griff did just that. He opened the lid, got out, said cheerio to George Platts, and rushed off through the fields. There were Germans about, heading for the mosquito, and of course they picked up Platts with his broken leg, and he was eventually put into Stalag Luft 3 at Sagan and spent the rest of the war there, coming home after the war ended in 1945. But Griff, fear probably lent him wings, and he sped over the ground and into a farmyard, and he said that he rushed into the middle of the farmyard and fell down a well. I should think it's far more likely that he saw the well and dived into it. Anyway, he got into there, and although the Germans came into the yard looking for him, they didn't find him. There he was, down at the bottom of this well. And in the evening, when the Germans had all gone, the farmer arrived at the top of the well and said, "Psst, psst, monsieur." And Griff said, "Allo." He was a Canadian, you see. He spoke very oddly. And the farmer wound him up in the bucket, seized on him and kissed him, I presume, on both cheeks, and then fed him and said, "Well, you better stay here because the advance isn't all that far down the road. You better stay here until we can get you away." What in fact happened was that he stayed there about 2 weeks in this farm, going down into the well in the morning and up again at night, and having a decent night's sleep. It must have been awful for him just sitting down there all day, but he did. And eventually the advance rolled over him, and he was brought back to this country. So he was an evader. He got away, he was never caught, and he didn't move out of the place he had got to after the crash. And he was seized on at 627 Squadron as a great hero. So that was the story of Griff and George Platts.